Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Food for Thought, a podcast gabfest where in a multiracial mix of queer writers gather around the table to talk about sex, identity, culture, what we like to read, and who we like to read. Food for Thought. Get your hands caught in our cookie jar.
No, please don't. You sometimes have to go to the hospital for that.
Oh, my God.
Thank you for setting the tone for this episode.
I'm Tommy Teebs Pico, an Indigenous American poet, editor, and the man of a thousand laughs.
Daddy.
Oh, my God. I quit.
Just have to take a break. I'm Fran. I'm a writer, editor, and apologizing is against my religion.
I'm Joseph Osmondson, scientist, nonfiction writer, and I'm a top for Call Me By Your Name, the book, but a bottom for Call Me By Your Name, the movie.
Oh, true.
And I'm Dennis Norris II, and I'm a reader, writer, former figure skater, and I, too, have fucked a peach.
Oh my God!
Wait! Did you top the peach, Dennis? Did you top the peach,
girl? No.
Wait.
So this was like anal beads, but peaches?
What is going on?
What? Everyone is freaking out right now.
Did you just stick the pit up inside?
We're talking. This is just up is down, inside is out. We've talked about inversions today. Jesus,
oh, we sure have.
Freaking Christ, Dennis. Can you just tell us what's on the menu so we can get along with this?
So, for today's episode, we ask who goes gay for play. Joe gives the thought stamp of approval on herpes. We discuss our big screen loves, Elio and Oliver. And for dessert, we follow a new shining star to glory.
Yes! Woo! Take it away, nom nom nom, babe.
Nom 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 thoughts. Let's start the top of this show off the way any good top should, with a little tease. Our uproarious appetizer segment, Amuse Boosh. And to amuse your booshes today, I'm going to play a game with you called Gay for Play.
I am so excited about
wherein
this.
Where I give you a list of actors and actresses, and you have to guess whether or not they have played LGBTQ the big screen. Now, a fair warning, I do mean big screen. As in, it's got to be a movie in the theaters.
And not a TV show.
I was just going to ask that question.
I was really hoping Gay for Play meant something else.
I have a feeling this game is going to have some very big reveals on our age differences. And which celebrities we can recognize.
Completely agree.
So I'm gonna start you off easy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because that's where I like to go. So first off, let's do Jake Gyllenhaal.
Who's that? Just kidding.
Fran?
He definitely has.
Yeah, he has been Gay for Play, yes. Mm-hmm.
He has.
Yes, that's right. Of course, Jake Gyllenhaal played a gay cowboy who takes it up the poop chute by the Dear Departed.
Fuck off. You've been saving that.
By the Dear Departed Heath Ledger in Brokeback Mountain.
Did you have to start this game off with poop shoot?
You didn't even.
You are
done.
Fact that I have not said poop shoot for, what, 20 episodes now?
True.
Count your motherfucking blessings. All right, next up we've got Clint Eastwood. Fran?
I'd say no.
Joe?
I'm also going to go no. Toxic masculinity, I don't think so.
Such a Republican.
For some reason, I feel like this is a yes.
Well, Clint Eastwood has never played gay in a movie, but the famously conservative actor did support marriage equality in 2013.
Wow. Whoa!
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Next up, we've got Jennifer Lawrence.
I would say, I want to say no.
I'm like horrible at movies, but I'm gonna say yes. I couldn't pick her out of a lineup. Which like white actress is she?
Oh my God. I have the same problem with like Victoria Beckham.
Okay, Fran.
Well, that's a Spice Girls issue and we'll get to that. But I always thought that Katniss Everdeen was secretly a lesbian.
Oh my God, that's so true. Mm-hmm.
That's who that is.
It is. Yeah.
Jennifer Lawrence has never played explicitly lesbian before, but
But she does play Mystique in the X-Men movies.
Right.
And Mystique in the comic books
is a lesbian.
Has had lesbian relationships before.
Right.
Most famously with her precognitive buddy, Destiny.
Destiny, right.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a Destiny, ain't it?
Next up, we've got Annette Bening.
I definitely know the answer is yes. I guess I shouldn't say that, but I know the answer is yes.
Yeah, is that Save the Children, What's with the Children movie?
The kids are, it's called The Kids Are All Right, and it's an amazing movie. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, she has.
It is an amazing movie, and it's because the kids are all right, because shockingly, lesbians can raise children.
Julianne Moore has this monologue in that movie.
Oh, it's so good.
Every time I watch it, I cry.
All right, now we're still firmly in the world of Kids Are All Right. How about Mark Ruffalo, Fran?
He has. I want to say he has.
He has gay face IRL, so, I mean, to me, he plays gay in every movie that he's in.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say he hasn't.
The answer is, in fact, no.
Mark
Ruffalo played gay in Normal Heart, but that was an HBO movie.
That was
movie.
HBO. Mm-hmm.
I'll bet
Not
you it's
the big screen
in a theater.
Fran is so mad.
I'm pissed.
Anyway, Fran would not do well in law school.
Next up, we've got Michelle Rodriguez.
No idea who that is.
Really?
No.
How can you claim to be an arbiter of pop culture and not know who Michelle Rodriguez is?
I never claim to be an arbiter of pop culture.
Well, you like to edit people.
That's true.
I am.
I love editing people.
I am not an arbiter of pop culture, and I have no idea who that is.
Michelle Rodriguez, Fast and the Furious.
I've never seen any of those movies.
Yeah. I'm going to say no, that she has not.
I'm going to go ahead and say that she has. And I'm also going to say, isn't she like kind of queer in life? Because when she was dating like Zac Efron or someone, it was like a big deal.
She's bi. She is queer. And she has played, she's like been in every action movie basically from like 2000 until like yesterday. She's never actually played lesbian. Although in a movie called The Assignment, she plays a hitman named Frank who wakes up and has had sex reassignment surgery.
Oh.
Problematic. It's problematic. And Frank has a girlfriend, and Michelle has some sexy times with her, but
I think this might be what I'm remembering, though.
Next. Next. Next.
How about Gina Rodriguez, Jane the Virgin?
Oh. I've never seen that series. I don't know who she is.
Oh, damn.
I don't think so. I don't know if she's been in a lot of things that I've seen on the big screen at all, but I don't think so.
I'm also going to say I don't think so.
Gina Rodriguez hasn't played gay yet, but she is going to play a lesbian paramedic in the Natalie Portman sci-fi film Annihilation coming soon.
Wow. All right, Gina.
I just pre-ordered the tickets while we were talking.
Latinx lesbian. Yes. Come through, Gina. Now, we support you, girl.
Speaking of Natalie Portman, how about Natalie Portman?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I feel like the answer is definitely yes. I mean, yeah.
Not officially.
Did
but
she make
Black
out with
Swan
herself?
Is like
Black
pretty
Swan.
Gay.
Well, it's so
she
gay.
Mila Kunis eats her out for like full, a full scene.
But
like,
if
that doesn't mean
not
she's gay, but she played a gay thing. I don't know. I don't understand the parameters of this game.
I mean,
I'm lost and confused.
Sometimes we don't need words. Like, we saw the scene on the screen. I feel like it counts.
While we're on the topic of Black Swan, I will say I still have not been taken to Swan Lake since our last episode. And I'm,
wow.
Anybody who wants to take me to go see Swan Lake, the ballet. Yeah.
Friend, you and me, baby. Yeah. You and me. Let's do it.
Someone recently DM'd me that it was coming to Seattle. I don't know how that's helpful to you.
I can't even.
Go to Seattle. You can see it in Seattle.
All right, so next up, we've got Daniel Craig, James Bond himself.
In a commercial. Didn't he do it in a commercial?
Bud Light, maybe? I don't know.
No, no, no. He dressed in drag for a commercial. Wait. Yes.
Fran, I'm going to say no. I think I would have heard news flashes about that.
I'm going to go ahead and say yes, because he certainly played it in the big screen of
I feel
my
like
head
some
last
of our,
night.
Some of our fans who actually know movies are going to be like shouting at the at how like awful we are at
I know this one.
Daniel Craig played a gay convicted killer Perry Smith in the Truman Capote biopic Infamous and even had a steamy prison kiss scene.
And also in the James Bond movie with Javier Bardem, there was a very, very slight gay part.
Mm. Huh.
There's like a very, like, because this is just a very slight sense that James Bond is
Wait,
gay.
So is this the pick that Philip Seymour Hoffman won the Oscar for, or the other one? Because there
the
were
other
two...
one, okay. Capote was the one that Philip Seymour Hoffman was in.
Yep.
Infamous was the
but
other
But there
one.
Was another... Yeah, and they came out around the same time.
Yep. Next up, this is at number 10, our last one, Will Smith.
Okay.
Rude.
I know. Yes.
Yes?
I'm going to go ahead and say yes.
Will Smith played a gay man in Six Degrees of Separation. He was a pathological liar pretending to be Sidney Poitier's son. He also had a kiss scene in that movie, but because, you know, Will Smith ain't no homo or whatever, it was actually a trick of the camera where his face passed, the back of his head passed over the camera, so it looked like he was making out with the dude, but they didn't actually kiss.
Shut Will Smith up. Refused to kiss a guy.
Although we all know the streets talk, and there are lots of rumors about him and Jada.
Yeah, there are.
Lots.
Oh my God.
And I would watch anything that happens with either of them. They are both spectacular.
I mean, true.
All right, well, thanks for playing this game.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For our next segment, Joe O. the Science O is going to serve us some herpes.
Like I already have all over the tri-state area. Uh-huh. Hi, everybody. So I'm here to talk about science in our, like, twice a season Joe O. the Science Ho segment. And I'm really interested in this because I'm a scientist by training. That's what I have my PhD in. But I also do some work in sort of the science studies field, which is like trying to make sense of how scientific knowledge is made and how it's understood and then how it sort of reflects and refracts culture. And there's basically what happened is there's been this revolution in scientific research in the last 15, 20 years, whereas for basically all of the 20th century, we viewed microbes, viruses, and microorganisms, and bacteria essentially as negative things, things that made us sick. And everything was about, like, sterilizing our world from them. You bleach everything, you know, your fucking sprays kill 99.9% of bacteria and viruses. You try to keep yourself as clean, quote unquote, and sterile as possible.
Like Army Hammer.
But what's been happening in the last 20, 25 years of research is that this idea has been completely turned on its head. And we're starting to understand how viruses and bacteria are not just bad at all, and they're not just things that are in the universe, but they're actually a part of us. They actually make us who we are. For example, the human body has 10 times more bacterial cells on and in it than human cells. Oh, so you can view the human body essentially as a walking incubator for other types of organisms.
None of you touch me.
Yum.
And then it was also discovered that viruses and bacteria that we get actually initially literally from coming out of our mother's vagina, that kind of initiates our, like, how bacteria meet us in the world, actually program our immune system. They feed molecules to our nervous system. They set up organ and tissue development. Like, without microorganisms, we're actually not human, right? So what I love about this is that this idea of the self and other, this constant assault of invading species has been completely turned on its head. And that sort of has a lot of political and cultural ramifications. And one of my favorite studies in this field is on the herpes simplex virus.
Oh, my God.
And it is done by a man who goes by the name Skip Virgin.
Wow. You are kidding me.
Not only that, Skip Virgin the Third.
That is a stripper name. Skip Virgin the Third, porn star name.
And he has a very good microbiology group at WashU in St. Louis. And they're some of the first people who discovered that, like, if you actually take all microbes away from mice, so a mammalian a mammal that we use as a model organism in lots of studies, if you take, like, all of the microorganisms away from them, they essentially don't develop immune systems at all. They don't develop some of their organs. And he did this study where they looked at herpes simplex. So this is the virus that causes herpes infections. And, you know, most people are infected with at least one. Basically, almost every human being on the face of the planet has a herpes virus, and it infects you and it never goes away. So it's one of these viruses that you get and you live with for all your life.
So everyone at this table has herpes.
Oh, like 17 herpes. Like, yeah.
And there
are
get
two,
at me.
There are two types
yeah,
of...
we're going to do well after
this. This is like, we're going to see how few people can slide into our DMs after this conversation. No, but you will believe by the end of this that herpes is sexy. So herpes gets up into
all right.
It's true.
Intrigued. Go on.
The gauntlet has been thrown down.
Herpes. Herpes gets up into your neurons, so that's where it lives. You get it.
I'm already hard.
HSV1. You get from it's typically oral herpes. You get it in your mouth, and it climbs up into your neurons that what we call innervate. So the neurons that go into that part of your body, and it lives there. And herpes is always trying to activate itself and cause a cold sore or a new infection. And your immune system is constantly trying to tamp down that infection.
Wow, is anyone as turned on as I am right now?
But what they found is that actually this infection where the herpes virus is living in your neuron forever and ever and ever, and basically everyone...
My neuron?
Your fucking neuron.
My special neuron? What?
That actually prevents certain types of bacterial infections.
Oh.
Right? So in mice that were constantly infected with chronic herpes and it's always trying to reactivate itself, they were better able to fight off certain bacterial infections. Basically what that means is that like the herpes is kind of priming the pump. It's getting your like immune cells ready to like go into, you know, I'm going to use horrible language, but go into quote unquote battle. They're ready to take the fight on of the bacteria coming in. And without the herpes, essentially your immune cells aren't quite ready and the bacteria gets a little ahead. And basically the idea here is that a virus like herpes that has been essentially in humans and other primates since we were humans is basically co-evolved. You can almost view it as a component of our immune system, right? So this thing that we have so long thought of as like, oh my God, herpes, that's disgusting, blah, 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 blah. Actually, it's something that humans have always had that actually one can view as a positive component of what keeps you quote unquote healthy.
So you're saying our listeners should go seek out herpes.
Go
like
get,
everyone should go get herpes for the betterment of themselves.
Slide into my DMs.
Yes. Everyone please give Joe herpes. That is what he's saying.
And at the very least, like, you don't have to be self-conscious if you have it.
You don't, yeah, right,
exactly.
Right.
That's so, the real
That's really liberating.
The other thing about herpes is that even with, so HSV-1 is the oral herpes, HSV-2 tends to cause genital herpes. And there's a lot of stigma around both of these, around cold sores, but in particular around genital herpes. Many, you know, in the queer community, many, many people have genital herpes. 90% of people who are infected with herpes never get a single outbreak, right? So if you have sores due to genital herpes, you're not alone. Like, number one, you're not alone. A lot of people do. But number two, there should be no stigma attached to that because everyone else has the virus. It's just you're one of the unlucky 10% that has an infection, right? Mm-hmm. And I just love all of this research because it really breaks down the idea that viruses like HIV or like herpes are actually some sort of exogenous assault on the human body as opposed to sort of this long, ongoing, never-ending sort of co-evolution between microbes, including viruses, including bacteria, and humans. And yes, there's some things that can make us sick, but like that sickness is just a sickness. It doesn't have to be something that is both puts your body in danger and puts your social body in danger, and right?
Also, like, yeah. At least in terms of like communicable diseases that we've co-evolved with, it's not like fucking tuberculosis or something like that. Like, it doesn't kill us.
Right. Yeah, and I think that another way that people misunderstand microorganisms, and particularly viruses tend to evolve from very virulent, that is, meaning that they kill a lot, to essentially not virulent at all, right? Because it's really, if you think about from the evolutionary strategy of a virus, it doesn't want to kill the thing that it needs to replicate. Mm-hmm. It doesn't want to, HIV doesn't want to kill you because then you're dead and the virus is also dead with you, right? So viruses tend to start out in their evolutionary trajectory very, very deadly and then end up co-evolving to the point where they can be transmitted but actually don't kill the host. So again, it's constantly like, and the human genome has a shit ton of viruses integrated into it, of viruses that human beings met thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago that evolved toward essentially living in and with us without causing any pathology at all, right? And so I think I just want to end with this idea from Susan Sontag, who has this amazing writing on bodies and illness. Her two books are called Illness as Metaphor and HIV and its Metaphors. And she talks a lot about the way that we talk about illness kind of doubly infects us. Like, we first have to deal with the illness of the body, and then we have to deal with the illness of the language that's used. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things that she argues is that we shouldn't use military rhetoric when we talk about illness, that we should just talk about illness as something that happens to the body and not about this battle, this war. And that really, I think, is very much in line with this new research that shows that we actually are in a co-evolution with microbes.
It makes me think a lot of too, in like app culture with DDF, drug and disease free, mm-hmm, exactly, or clean and negative, mm-hmm, or the ways in which like, mm-hmm, people, in addition to it being the result of a pathology, then pathologizing people on top,
exactly,
of that.
So Susan Sontag writes, but the wars against disease are not just calls for more zeal and more money to be spent on research. The metaphor implements the way particularly dreaded diseases are envisaged as an alien other, as enemies in a modern war. And the move from the demonization of the illness to the attribution of fault to the patient is an inevitable one, no matter if the patients are thought of as victims. Victims suggest innocence, and innocence, by the inexorable logic that governs all relational terms, suggests guilt, right? So she's essentially arguing that we take all of this away, and she was writing that, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and here we are in 2018, decades later, and research is essentially finally catching up to this idea that she put out, that we, you know, there is no battle between us and them. There's actually only a unified one.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, that's so beautiful, Joe. Science really does make everything better.
Go live your herpes-filled life.
Go get herpes, everyone.
Go live.
All right, for our next segment, the meat of our conversation, the thought process spelled T-H-O-T, we're doing our first book club of the season.
Yay.
Yes. With Call Me By Your Name, which you know it. I know it. We all know it. It's award show season. We wanted to throw you a bone. Seeing as how this is coming out the week before the Academy Awards, where Timothée is nominated for Best Actor. And, you know, this is very much a part of our climate at the moment. So, of course, I feel like I shouldn't even, at this point, I think it would be condescending to even try to go over the plot, but Call Me By Your Name is set in the 1980s and the Italian Riviera and the budding intimate relationship between, I was going to say Timothée, between Elio, 17-year-old, precocious musician and I don't know, whatever. I don't want to even say, he's not an academic, he's too young for any of that. And
he's
also like...
But he's the son of an academic.
The son of an academic. And then the grad student... Oliver.
He's a postdoc, I believe.
Who's like staying at Elio's father's mansion for the summer. And the, you know, the twists and turns of this plot and how they come together and go apart and then what happens, you know, 20 years later. I'm curious, though, to know maybe what are some of your general thoughts about, because I want to talk, you know, about the book and the implications of the book, its translation into a film and your feelings about the film as well. Oh, but God. I guess maybe some general thoughts about the book first.
I really think this is one of the few cases where I liked the movie more than the book. Which Fran and I agree about a lot of things in this. What I didn't like about the book is a little bit different than why Fran didn't like the book. I made a post on the Instagram early on that I was like, I'm so tired of reading this book, which I'm calling On the Longings of Rich People.
So exhausting.
But what I found is that the interiority, I love books with a lot of interiority, and particularly with interiority that has a longing in it. Like I loved Garth Greenwell's What Belongs to You, which I think is this book, but better. But I get so, I find Elio in the book so insufferable. He's kind of like mean to the help. He like is just so, maybe it's because I'm too similar to him and I have similarly toxic thought patterns, but I just was so frustrated being in his head.
What about him was so irritating
to
you?
So I found that, I mean, most 17-year-olds are irritating in that
Teens are awful.
Teens
just
are
across
awful.
The board. I'm sorry, true. Teens that are listening to the show.
No, we love y'all. Hop on that, and I'm going to hop on that and say the exact same. I'm going to agree with Joe and also say, yeah, teens are awful. I was, the first 100 pages of this book, I was like, is this the third Hunger Games? Like, I couldn't get over
it. Hungry for cock games.
No, because the third Hunger Games book has such horrible internal monologue, and it's the whole book, and it's so infuriating. And to me, yeah, I think the biggest like downfall of the book is the first 100 pages where you spend so much time inside Elio's head. And I kept, for the first 100 pages, I was like, this should have been a novella.
This should have been
so much shorter. There was so much agony in those first 100 pages. And I was like, I can only take this for so long. But I'm going to, you know, hop on Joe, on Joe's comment and say, like, I'm going to hop on Joe physically right now here in the studio.
Everyone's been waiting.
Oh, my God. All that sexual tension has been building and
is
building and building.
Is it sexual tension or a fight? Like, what are we doing? Or both?
I was frustrated. And then after... the first 100 pages, I started to really enjoy the book.
I did too.
Yeah, I felt like, and so there's a, I don't actually know if it's exactly 100 pages, but at, when they finally kind of
get together,
when they are physically together, the internal monologue is less so. It's still there, but it's less so for Elio. And there's more physicality, and there's more dialogue, absolutely, and there's a lot more nuance in the complications between how they communicate, which I found very real. And to me, the biggest feat of this book, and also of the movie, is its ability to portray that hormonal crush and the longing. So what I found to be the most annoying thing about it was also, I think, it's
so much
its greatest feat toward the end, because I just saw myself in Elio over and over and over again. And I, even in the insufferable 80 pages, I got to the end of the book and I was like, I remember exactly when I had this conversation with my mom. I remember exactly when I felt this way about this guy and when they ignored me, and like so many like mirror images of myself.
Absolutely.
Well, I also,
Dennis.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I also think like my reading was really similar in that I also like really struggled to get through the first 100 pages. And then once something started to happen, I started being a lot more interested. And I just think that the nature of the longing changes once he's longing for something that has happened. Like beforehand, it's so tortured and it's so extra. And it's like, does he like me? Does he not like me? Blah, blah, blah. But once something happens and Elio has something to grab onto and to hold on and to hold on to.
Literally.
Metaphorically and emotionally.
It is actually metaphorically, because they never show you what he holds on to.
They
the
do not.
The book has some sex in it.
The book does have some sex in it, but... It eclipses. We'll get there.
I actually think that the book writes about sex in a really interesting way. It's one of its greatest strengths for me. But I was just going to say that, like, once it actually happens, that's when the longing gets much more interesting. And I think that the writing actually is much more elevated in those moments, too, because he's writing about something that isn't just, like, theoretical. And so just the sentences, to me, are tighter and a lot more efficient, and there's much more power in all of them. Beforehand, it just gets a little
and more
crazy.
Forward movement.
And I can understand that too. I had the opposite reading, which was I liked the first half of the book more than the second half. And I thought too, because see, what we're talking about is like temporality, essentially, and this idea towards the end where it's like that people live parallel lives, right?
Yes.
One of them that is like fantasy, and then one is what they're actually doing. And so much of the front half is like his fantastical self, giving us so many different scenarios. He's like giving, like, you know, you don't know if so and so was actually in his bed. You don't know if he's standing in front of him in the robe. If it's like if it's a penis or if it's like a tennis racket or whatever.
Like, and he's constantly being like, what if he came into my room at night? What if he like put his gym shorts over me? What if he or whatever?
Yeah,
he kept saying, what if?
And that like one of the things I liked the most about Elio as a character was the fact that he was super ambivalent about, like, he wanted it so bad, but then he was also, he had those moments where it was like, if this person stands me up, am I comforted by that?
Yeah.
You know? And that, like, I thought of it a lot about, I kept thinking about the poet Hart Crane. And I think a lot of Hart Crane's poetry has a similar cycle to it. I mean, he writes very, very complicated verse because he has a very, very complicated relationship to his sexuality. But like, if you deep read and you just look at those words and you read them one by one
gay
and you look them up, it's just about fucking coming on wallpaper
shit.
Like, it's actually super duper simple.
Yeah.
But I saw these, like, his poetry is all about this cycle of like doubt and fear and discretion, and then a rub, and then the buildup, and then the release, and then the shame, and then the doubt, and then the fear, and the discretion, and the rub, and then the buildup, and then the release, and then the shame. And like, I saw that happening in that character, even when they had, like, even when it was outside of the realm of his imagination, right? And the scary thing about making a decision, the scary thing about admitting your desire to somebody is that they could not give it to you.
But the thing about
queerness is that it's not just about being embarrassed. We could literally be killed.
Yeah.
You know, like, we face death for saying what it is we want from people. So then I started to understand these passages where he would say something like, I derived a certain satisfaction in concealing my feelings for him, you know, or he would say like, I had to let him know I was totally indifferent to him, you know, and I saw myself so hard in that character in those moments, because all I ever do is like, when I want somebody really bad, is turn away from them and be like, bitch, I don't care.
Same, I love ignoring people. Wow.
But I actually felt, I mean, I, you know, that's very true of the world and queerness in general. But I felt like the world, and I think that one people respond to in the movie in particular, but also in the book, is sort of the irreality of the world in which they're living. It's like this dreamscape of the Italian Riviera. And I don't sense the threat of violence anywhere in this book, right?
But that's why, but I think like that's what makes it a different story, is that like there isn't a villain.
There isn't.
Yeah. And it's funny because a big part of why they can't express their feelings to each other is societal reasons. But they don't, there are very few times where they say, oh, we can't because society. You know?
Yeah.
That really isn't, they really do, when it comes down to it, kind of like the hiding. They love the sneaking around. They love the parts of this relationship that like, that is a little taboo. And like, I think that something that was fascinating to me is how everything changes once they're able to be themselves. And then the problem of the novel isn't, are we going to kiss? Are we going to kiss? The problem of the novel is like, is he thinking about me at this very moment? Like, well, what is it? Is this a relationship? Are we in love? Is this domestic? Is this just sex?
Right. Like, is there a future? I think the fundamental question of the second half of the novel is, oh my God, like we have this love that is like the love of a lifetime. And is that, can it be the love of a lifetime? Right. And I think that for Elio, slight spoiler alert, you might want to just go forward 30 seconds. Like the notion that this place where they kiss in Rome is a place that Elio goes back to again and again for the whole rest of his life. And it is constantly marked by that desire and he never gets over it, speaks very much to this idea of parallel lives. And what Elio really desires is to have lived that life with Oliver. And what Oliver really desired, we actually don't know.
Well, because we're not in Oliver's head. We're in Elio's head, and we're only ever imagining what Oliver is thinking.
That's right.
And dealing with what he says, which is like why in the beginning when he's such a jerk, you're like, what is this person's major malfunction? But it's actually like he was also struggling to conceal his feelings for Elio. And I think I want to get back to what Fran was talking about with this, the thrill of concealing something and then them partially living within that. But there is a passage, I think, on 52 where Elio's like, when he realizes or he thinks he's been able to successfully hide his attraction to Oliver from his parents, right? And he said, it told me that if I were no longer transparent and could disguise so much of my life, then I was finally safe from them, his parents, and from him, Oliver. But at what price? And did I want to be safe from anybody? And so I thought that made me think, like, what is the function of numbness, right? And I'm thinking about two things in particular. One of them is like, it's sometimes it's in the service of a greater healing process, like Novocaine or like anesthesia, right? Because you're trying to get better. But then there's this other one where in like, if you're trying to numb yourself from the pain of a relationship, right? But the pain of a relationship and of intimacy is something that's how you learn.
Yeah.
You learn through pain. That's the learning curve, right? And it made me think of like something like Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where they extract all of the painful memories of their relationship, but then because they do, they're doomed to repeat the same thing. And that like, that pain is a teacher.
Right.
You know?
This message comes from iHeartRadio sponsor, Mercury Insurance. If you're looking to save some money, you should really think about getting a quote from Mercury, because Californians save an average of $677 with Mercury. It's quick and easy, and in just a few minutes, you might find you could save a lot of money on your auto and home insurance. Plus, Mercury was named one of America's best insurance companies by Insure.com 4 years in a row. Low rates, big discounts, great insurance. Go to mercuryinsurance.com today to get a quote.
It's crazy how much we have to pay for outdated, impersonal healthcare, and even crazier that we all just accept it. It's time to face facts. Healthcare is backwards. Luckily, there's Forward, a new approach to primary care that's surprisingly personal and refreshingly straightforward. Forward never makes you feel like just another patient. Backed by top-rated doctors and the latest tech, Forward gives you access to personalized care whenever you need it. Using in-depth genetic analysis and real-time blood work, Forward's top-rated doctors provide you with in-depth insights to better understand your genetics, mental, and physical health. They then create custom, easy-to-understand plans to help guide you to achieving long-term health. With Forward, you get unlimited in-person visits with your doctor and access to care anytime via the Forward app, all for one flat monthly fee. It's time to stop accepting backwards healthcare and start moving your health forward. Visit GoForward.com today to learn more. That's GoForward.com.
Me, but also you. The Pharaoh fast-forwards his favorite foreign film. Powder donut.
Okay, what's my line?
The only line I see here on the script is get options based on your budget with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive.
Oh man, that's a tongue twister, huh? I'm sorry, I'm gonna need a few more minutes. Bulbous Walrus, the Bulbous Walrus.
The Name Your Price tool, only from Progressive.
The owl ran afoul of the comatose coxswain.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi guys, Katie Lowe's here. You might know me as Quinn Perkins on Scandal. I'm also the host of Katie's Crib, a podcast about all things parenthood. Katie's Crib is back with new episodes every Thursday. We have got such an awesome lineup of guests. Michelle Buteau on having twins, Katerina Scorsone on raising three children, Kat McPhee Foster on being a new mom. We'll be covering everything from discipline to mom-ring. Tune in. Listen to Katie's Crib on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Not to go there too quickly, but the father's gorgeous speech at the end that Teebs and I sort of talked about is the thesis moment of the book and the film, right, where the father essentially says, admits to the relationship to Elio. And actually, I was surprised that sort of Elio was receptive to that, given that he spends some of the novel sort of getting off on and being afraid of people finding out. Mm-hmm. But the father sort of acknowledges the fact of the relationship to him and says, well, now you feel pain and feel that pain. Mm-hmm. Don't close yourself off to the pain, because that's also closing yourself off to and not admitting to the joy of this relationship. And if you start at 17 not admitting to the joy of this relationship, you'll never have joy in future relationships, right? So this sort of the cycle of pain is also opening yourself and keeping yourself open to the possibility for joy.
And you have to be careful, because not all pain is growth.
Like, Teebs is looking right at me when he says that.
Joe, you've been found out.
No. Because
no one ever knew.
I mean, growth.
Everyone
because,
knew.
Because it's because growth comes with a requisite amount of pain.
Yes.
But some pain is just damage. Oh, you know?
Or maybe indulgence?
But then on the opposite side of that, you know, when the father also says, you know, don't cut yourself off from pain, because then you cut yourself off from joy. I'm mm-hmm. curious what you guys think about happiness, because there's a part where Elio waffles in between this notion that I often find myself going in between, right? Where he says, I think this on 49, when he's talking about happiness, he's like, all I had to do was find the source of happiness in me and not rely on others to supply it the next time. But then, later on the page, it says, was he, Oliver, then my homecoming. You are my homecoming. When I'm with you and we're together, there's nothing more I want. You make me like who I am and who I become when you're with me, right? So I'm curious what you guys think about that. Like, does one negate the other? Is one truer than the other? The idea that you can find a source of happiness inside of yourself, or you are happy because of what's around you?
Teebs, I think that's a really interesting question. And that was actually one of the most thought-provoking passages for me when I was reading it myself. And I think that was where I began to think about the idea that the book to me, or at least Elio's thinking within the book, is predicated on the idea that we find ourselves when we find the person who sort of reflects ourself back to us. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I think that that's not true, because in some ways, I think that that is true. But I didn't find those ideas to really conflict with each other. And I didn't necessarily find the idea of having a person be your homecoming as the same thing as happiness. Like, I didn't naturally equate the two. Like, I think there is a difference between a happiness or a satisfaction that you find within yourself and your being and who you are, and finding your sort of safe space or your home, the surroundings that you need to, like, move sort of comfortably through the world in a person. Like, I just don't necessarily see those two things as the same thing. So I think I don't see them as being in conflict with each other necessarily. I think for some people they probably are.
I also think, hopping on that the interesting thing to me about their relationship is that Oliver could have been anyone. I think that he was not so much attached to Oliver as a person, as a character, as like this human that he's interacting, as it was his very first thing and his very first sense of like love and longing, this very first thrill. I saw him getting really riled up and really excited about all of the acts of the relationship, but I did not see, there was a lot of things about him as a character that he would point to, but I do think that in a lot of ways, it was just, it could have felt interchangeable. Like, it could have been a completely different character.
I totally agree with you, and especially because he's 17. But I think it's interesting because I was thinking about this too, because you really don't get much of a sense of who Oliver is as a person. Like, you see his behavior, you see the way he treats people, but you don't necessarily, I mean, there's no interiority from
him. It's hard to figure out why he likes him.
Wait. But is it just that, sorry, I was just going to say, but is it just that, like sometimes when people talk about love and being in love, they talk about the idea that, like, they can't explain it. It's just there. It's just in between them. And that it's just this sort of chemistry, this connection that they don't necessarily understand, but they feel it where they don't feel it in other places. And so that was interesting because I sort of took it for granted that that was what the author was going for when he was explaining this relationship. Or that was the justification that I had when I was like, why is Elio so in love with this guy? And so that's sort of how I think that love maybe operates.
But I think you guys, it's the author is arguing that it's the exact opposite of that. The author is arguing that it's the sameness between these two characters that is driving their love, that it's actually the fact that this was the first person he'd ever seen who was Jewish, for example. So there's this huge aspect of identity. It's the same sort of person he saw who was this version of masculinity that he was drawn to. The fact that they're calling each other by each other's name, which is almost this trope that gets annoying by the end of the book, is a deep reflection of the way in which love is a mirror. And it shows you this version of yourself that you want to be. Right, for me, there's so much identity and there's so much longing to be like this person and to see yourself in this person. There's so much specific that I could argue about Oliver that Elio is drawn to from his longing. It's not just, and I think the fact that he longs for him his entire life, even through many other loves, argues that there's a deep sameness and a deep identity that he's longing for in this person. And it's not actually generic at all. And that it is actually incredibly specific to this body, to this summer they spent together, to the identity markers that they share, including their Jewish heritage, their academic identity, the fact that they can have these conversations about how many philosophers do they joke to each other about? How many etymology jokes? There's this deep sameness. So it's like the fact that they saw each other they saw themselves in each other is the idea that anyone will read the book as like sort of that type of desire you have for another male body because it's around. But there's so much specific that I think he is so drawn to.
I agree with you, Joanna. I'm going to say this just because, and this is Steve's, but I'm going to say this because once we got to around page 68, which is a disputed page amongst the thoughts, but I started to see the narrative actually open up, and I started to see it for its subtext, and I started to see that, like, and it's around page 68 when Elio's kind of like, Oliver, you know, we used to be the same. How do I know this and not you? That, like, at one point we were together and whole. And that's when I started to see it as, like, a recapitulation of the Aristophanes' origin of love myth, which is in Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes has this speech where he talks about the origin of love. The reason I know this isn't because I know anything about Plato. It's because I know the movie Hedwig and the Angry Inch. and one of the songs in Hedwig is called The Origin of Love. And basically what he argues is that at one point, humans were round and they were like back to back. And there were ones that were men and men and women and women and a man and a woman. They were the children of the sun, which was the men, and the children of the earth, which is the women, and the children of the moon, which was the androgynous one. And that because we were complete together, that provided an affront to the gods, and Zeus split us all in half so that we would be forever looking for the other part of our person. Mm-hmm. And that, like, that's what all this, like, Call Me By Your Name is the title of the book, because it's like, when we're together, I'm you and you're me.
Exactly. Yes. And that sex helps facilitate that. That sex literally breaks down the boundaries between your body and my body and your body and my body. So it's during sex that they call each other by each other's name. And particularly gay sex is a type of sex where, my God, when someone is inside of me, do I ever feel like I am the same contiguous body as them, right? They're in my booty hole. My poop chute.
While we're on this topic, can we talk about, like, the portrayals of sex, both in the book and in the movie?
Yeah,
because, like, I was so fascinated by, one, Twitter's response to the lack of sex scene in the movie. Because
absolutely.
I remember watching the movie and, like, it eclipses, like, it goes away.
Turns to the window.
The camera literally turns away from the sex scene so you don't see it. I remember rolling my eyes and being like, oh, of course not. Like,
of course.
We're never going to get a gay sex
scene. The same thing happens in Moonlight, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's so many, we're just, like, so starved for it. But at the same time, I remember leaving the theater angry, and I sat with it for a little bit, and I was like, you know what? Like, it sucks that a movie that is not that bad is under so much fire simply because we don't have enough mainstream representations out there to pull from. I don't think every movie that has gay people in it needs to have gay sex. We don't need that. And to me, the function of art as it stands is not to immediately reflect all of life and everything that we do as gay people. If every gay movie had to have gay sex in it, I mean, that's just a really esoteric way of thinking about what art is.
I mean, I think that's too, from the perspective of everyone in this room, who is, we also make things.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. So we understand the limitations, that all we're trying to do is like tell a story, not trying to be everything that right. is not represented.
Exactly. And don't get it twisted. All my books will have gay sex in them. Like, any movie that I produce will have gay sex in it. However,
why people are so mad is because this story has sex in it.
Well, I was going to say that my problem with the sex scene, or the lack of sex scene, was a problem that I had pretty much throughout the movie. Which, and I think it's beautiful, and I did enjoy myself, and I did, from the second Timothy was in the phone booth being like, "Mom, come get me," when his voice cracked right there, I just started to cry, and I didn't stop until the end of the movie. Yeah. However, I think what the film suffers from is that it transitions too quickly all the time. And I spent most of last year, this is Tommy, I spent most of last year writing a feature for a production company. And I learned some things about writing during that time that, like, I just had to learn by doing it, by the process. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, when something transitions too fast, it's the person not being able to write themselves out of the scene.
Mm.
So there was, so it cut away too quickly all the time, and I couldn't get rooted into any one scene too much. Mm-hmm. And there are ways in which, like, those conversations could have happened and then, like, moved through into another one. But as it was too jarring. And so I think one of the problems that I had with it was that thing about cutting too quickly. And then that's something that the sex scene suffered from as well.
Yeah. I didn't hate the movie, but I walked away being like, that was a very, very long, beautifully art-directed gay porn with no gay sex scenes, and also maybe less of a plot.
You are not the only person I've heard that from, to be 100% honest.
I really feel... I feel like gay porn has more plot than the movie did. And that doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the movie, because plotless movies, or rather like super duper plot movies, like are not every movie has to be a super, super plot movie. But I do feel like that was what I walked away with.
Can we talk about the speech at the end that the father gives?
Oh my God.
Elio, which is when he says, "We rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster than we should, that we go bankrupt by the age of 30 and have less to offer each time we start with someone new. But to feel nothing so as not to feel anything. What a waste."
What a waste.
And I was definitely sobbing at that part in the movie. I mean, I remember reading that part in the book and being like, drag me to hell.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Because I feel like it's such an MO of mine.
It's just a thesis statement for me. I mean, that's how I live my life, right? Is that like you have to feel everything for as long or maybe longer than what you think you should, Fran?
I read that scene in the book and was thrown back years and years ago when my boyfriend broke up with me, and I never share anything with my parents. I'm very closed off, very cagey. I remember calling my mom, or rather my mom called me just to like check in and say hi, and she's like, "What's going on? How's it going?" This was the second boyfriend that I'd ever like told my parents about, and he had just broken up with me, and so we were just having a normal conversation, and I thought I was doing pretty great. Like, I had had like kind of a shit day because he had literally broken up with me that day, but I was like, "You know what? You're doing fine, Fran." And then she was like, "So how's..." And I was like, "He broke up with me." And like, I remember crying, like literally imagine me in the kitchen and collapsing on the floor, crying on the phone with my mom because
damn,
I was
you're
so
an
upset.
Amy Winehouse song.
Literally, though. Yeah. And I remember my mom saying to me, because she knows who I am and how my emotions function, she was like, "I'm so proud of you for making yourself vulnerable.
Oh, baby.
I am so proud of you for going out there and putting yourself out there and like literally taking the risk of love and what that feels like. I'm so proud of you, and you should not come away with this as in a broken way. You should come away with this as a triumph."
Yes.
I mean, that's amazing. I think that's definitely one of the best parts of the experience of reading this book for me. And that was one of the moments where I felt like I went back and forth in terms of whether or not I felt like it was like a queer book or a not queer book. But that was one of those moments where I felt like it so was, because I think so much of queerness, especially early on and in that age, is all about covering up those moments and hiding it because there is so much extra risk that comes to putting it out in the world. And in that moment, for his parent and very specifically his father to give him that affirmation. And the nature of it is not even necessarily about him being queer or not being queer. It's just that he's saying you need to like embrace all of your feelings and feel them and experience them and not cut yourself off, as we've been saying. But his circumstance in that moment and in that situation is queerness. And so the idea that his father is the one who does that was just huge for me, because like, anyone who knows anything about my writing at all knows that all I write about is gay boys, feminine gay boys, specifically with daddy issues. Like,
daddy issues.
Because our daddies haven't said to us some of the things that we need them to say. And so that was one of them. That was actually one of the most redeeming moments for me in the book, because it wasn't completely a book about like tragedy or heartbreak that was also queer, because there was that specific hope that was given.
It was like,
from a source that really
leave your heart open.
Yeah.
Did the dad kind of come out?
He
absolutely came out.
And I thought like when Elio was like, you know, the dad is like, I once almost had a special thing,
but
like
I
you've had
myself.
But and then like, you know, later Elio's like, does mom know?
Yeah.
And but that was confusing. I loved that
it's
part
supposed
of the
dialogue. To be.
It's I loved that because it was the other interesting thing about dialogue in the book and in the movie is that in the movie it was pretty much lifted, like completely untampered with into the movie, and like you never see that in movies. And movie adaptations of books. But yeah, I love that it was confusing because he kind of came out but didn't, so there was a little discrepancy.
Mm-hmm. And I love that it fucked up the straight relationship because the marriage of the parents is so idolized both in the book and the movie. They have this intellectual connection. They're so like, they have this gorgeous family. They have this gorgeous
They
love each other so deeply. And then at the end, essentially, the father kind of comes out. And he doesn't necessarily say I'm gay. But what he specifically says is, I have never in my life allowed myself to have the depth of feeling that you had with Oliver, which says directly, really? I don't have that with your mother. Right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if he comes out of the closet or not. What he says is, this marriage that through the entire book and through the entire movie you see as this idyllic marriage is actually kind of flat. And the father sort of envies the son for his heartbreak. And that, to me, I think was one of the most gorgeous moments of reflection that the book offers us as a gift.
Especially because in terms of the movie, at least, like, because the mother is given so much more to do.
Yeah.
And she, you know, you see her glance at Elio sometimes, and you know, she does know.
She does.
She absolutely does know.
She knows.
But she's lived with that man her whole life, and then she knows her son. So it's like, and they're kind of, and but the father's like, you know, no, she doesn't know about it. Like, there's like a turning away from that, but it's like,
she knows.
I felt this was more apparent in the movie than in the book, but the parents facilitated instances in which they could be together.
Yeah.
Not just in the trip, them buying a trip for them to roam together, like they bought them
or
a honeymoon.
Or the mountains.
Like, but there were so many ways in which they were just kind of like, oh, so how's Elio? Oh, so how's Oliver? Blah, blah.
Like, we'll let you talk on the phone later.
Oh my God. Bless you. The ending of the movie was so much better than the ending of the book.
Agreed.
The ending of the book was a trash pile garbage pan. I refused to acknowledge it as true. It was so garbage. It was worse than the epilogue at the end of the Harry Potter series.
It was.
But the exact same mistake from an author to just be like, oh, let's tie this out with a neat little bow. It'll be 4 years later and they like get a drink together and they're old and like, oh.
It was the worst last line in the history of America.
Oh my God. Spoiler, the last line is, call me by your name.
Yeah.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? Did you write this when you were in 11th grade creative writing class? I'm so pissed. And I refuse to acknowledge it as true. I refuse to believe that the end of this book is actually the book.
Have you guys heard that they're planning a sequel?
Fuck that.
Where,
fuck that noise.
Where an Elio dates women? After this?
I would rather see Shrek 3.
I would rather
watch it in 3D.
So next up on the show is Shrek 3 in 3D.
I think that's the perfect place to draw it out.
I got that feeling like I'm full, but I could fit one more thing inside of me. Dennis knows how I'm feeling. So to give us our dessert this week, it is going to be D.
Oh.
Yes, thank you, Tommy. Okay, so now that the Olympics are over, I'm going to talk to you guys about the person that I believe is going to be the face of U.S. figure skating for the next 4, possibly 8 years. Some of you may remember a viral video from 2010 of a little black girl doing a skating routine to Willow Smith's Whip My Hair. Uh-huh. It's got like 55 million views. I remember watching it in a Tim Hortons on my way to celebrate New Year's Eve.
Do you remember the moment and you are
watching?
You're not gay. You're not gay, right?
But I love donuts. That's the thing.
New Year's Eve?
I was going actually to celebrate New Year's with some friends
did
in a cabin in the
night?
Woods. I did not have sex that
okay,
night.
Good.
This
That's
is like,
okay, well,
I was still a virgin at this point in my life.
Oh my God.
Which is not where I wanted to go. But I saw this video and I remember watching this little girl skate and I immediately was like, this child has so much talent. She has so much potential. She clearly has good coaching because her technique was really sound. She had parents that were so invested in her skating that she was skating in skates that were decorated to look like Converse sneakers.
Oh, baby.
I was like, this is a child who has the resources behind her to go all of the way in figure skating and clearly has the talent. And so for the last 8 years, I have on occasion at more than even once a year looked her up on YouTube because this is the age of YouTube and followed her progress. I have, like, her family has at times like done GoFundMe campaigns to support her training, and I have contributed to those when I could. Like, I have stood behind this child and rooted for her because there have been so few black figure skaters who have reached the like elite level and the Olympic level. And so this year, this was Star, and her name is Star Andrews, and this was her senior debut where she competed at nationals for the very first time. And she, of course, was trying to make the Olympic team, and she didn't make the Olympic team. She finished sixth in the country, but in her senior debut, she was the skater who brought the entire audience to her feet. She skated to her own cover of Whitney Hughes' song, One Moment in Time. Unfucking believable. Unfucking believable. And in addition to the fact that we haven't had a black skater from America who's had this kind of potential since the 80s, since when I was born, which is so amazing, I want to talk about the fact that her skating life is blackety black, black, black. Her coach is black, Derek Delmore. I watched him compete at nationals in 1998, and after that, I got my first skating lessons because I saw him and he looked just like me. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's someone on the ice who looks like me. That is her coach. She's mentored by Ty Babylonia, who's an Olympic medalist from the 80s in pairs. And she skated this year to Fever by Beyonce for her short program and Whitney Houston and herself for her long program. Everything about her skating is black, and that just doesn't happen.
And her dance moves, the way she orients her body, the way she gyrates, the way she enters into the piece is so explicitly a part of who she is.
Yeah.
And there's so much coded language in the way they're critiquing the show live. They're always like, this is the future of figure skating. And I don't disagree with that, but I feel like they're being like, wow, like, black people are finally figure skaters.
But,
like,
but wait. Mm-hmm. Who was the French woman in the 90s?
Saria Bonnelly. Yeah.
Who was also, like, had so much, like, blackness in her movement. Mm-hmm. But at that time, it was so maligned. And even though she was so great, like, she didn't get good scores because she was athletic or all
she
of
was
these
muscular.
Like, these words that are used to malign people of color.
And all the time.
Also, they exotic.
And Serena Williams. They always exotic. So with Saria, it's really interesting because early in her career, she was adopted by a white family in France, and she was born in Nice, and that's where they adopted her. But her coaches came up with this idea that that her parents had traveled to Reunion Island, where they saw this little orphan, and they adopted her and gave her a life. It was all to exoticize Saria. And what was interesting with Saria's skating is that Saria had really ethnic hair. She had long natural hair earlier in her career. She had a really athletic, sort of very typically African kind of body, and she had all of this talent. And you're right, she was judged in the same, and she would skate to like African music. She was also super black, but in a different way, and she was amazing. But when I was a little kid and I watched Saria, I didn't relate to her because in my head she was French, and that was just like, I just didn't relate to her in that way. I just thought she was French. She has a white mother who is her coach. Like, it just, it didn't compute for me in the same way that Derek did, also because Derek was a guy when I saw him. But this child is like taking over American figure skating, and I'm so excited to see what happens next for her. And so anytime in your life that you need a little black girl magic, just go onto YouTube, type in Star with two R's, Andrews, and you're going to see this incredible performance from Nationals from her.
When she finished and everyone got up on their feet and she started crying, I started crying. It was so
good. I started crying. I was like, I'm crying. Why? I'm in this coffee shop. What's happening? And I have like a heart of stone. Like, nothing.
Fran does.
Let alone figure skating. That YouTube video brought me to tears. And also, Saria Bonnelly's performance where she does the illegal move of the backflip. Ugh. Where she does the one-legged backflip. She does a one-legged backflip and lands on the other one leg. And I remember watching that video like on my way somewhere because I just listened to a Radiolab yep. episode about it and just sobbing.
Because that was a big yeah. fuck you to
watched it yep. live. She wasn't going to get the scores same. That she wanted. So she already knew that she wasn't going to win. She already knew that she wasn't going to accomplish what it is her concrete goal was. She's like, I have a different goal now. I'm going to prove yeah. to all you motherfuckers that I'm the fucking best.
I'm better yeah. actually.
I yeah. literally can do something that no one has ever done before.
And
ever.
Literally no other skater has ever done that ever skill.
Done.
Ever. Not ever. A man. Like, no one. And yeah, it's Surya was incredible. She also, in that performance, finished with her back to the judges, which is like a no-no in figure skating.
No way!
Because yeah. So that was really, yeah, she finished with her back to the judges. You do not finish with your back to the judges. Oh, like, that is not God, a thing that you that. Do in this sport. Like, Surya was so fucking badass. And if I can just say for a minute, like, we have had, in terms of single skating, there have been three Black women who've really gotten to that level of skating. There was Debbie Thomas in the 80s, who won an Olympic bronze medal against Katarina Witt in the Battle of the Carmens. There was Surya Bonnelly, and now, potentially, if she gets as far as she can, and if she can stay healthy, and she has the support that she needs, we have Star Andrews, who could really, like, Star! Go all the way.
Her name is Star!
Her right name away, is baby. Star, which is also the blackest thing ever! I'm obsessed. Like, I'm obsessed. I can't, like, get enough. Every Black figure skater that I know, and I know many, like, some of us who got close to being elite, some of us who are like kind of in the middle, but every Black person I know who was a figure skater and who took their skating and their training seriously in any way watched that performance and like wept, because we all wanted to be that person at some point. We wanted to see that person at some point, and it has literally basically been generations since we have seen that person. So it was like this incredibly like moving moment for anyone who looks like her who is figure skating. And I think that she can really help to change the face of the sport and to get like more people of color enrolled in figure skating and hopefully open up access for lots of people.
Yes, light our way, Star.
Light our way.
Thank you so much for that dessert, Dennis.
Yeah.
This episode of Food for Thought is made possible by the generous, unequivocal support of Rosé and our partnership with Into, a digital magazine for queer news and culture. What are you into? Head to intomore.com each week for a new love letter from your bestie bosom benches.
That's right.
Our engineer is Alex Mead Fox at Spaceman Sound Studios, and our producer is the jam in our peanut butter sandwich, Alexandra De Palma.
Strawberry jam.
The most delicious part.
Apricot jam.
Apricot jam.
I'm Tommy Teebs Pico. You can find me at Hey Teebs, HeyTeebs on all relevant social media.
I'm Fran. You can find me at Fran Squish Co. on all relevant social media and also Venmo.
I'm Joseph Osmondson. You can find me at www.josephosmondson.com.
And I am Dennis Norris II, and I have a chapbook out, and you can find that Woo! Online at www.awst-press.com or my website, www.dennisnorrisii.com.
You can listen to Food for Thought on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download golden audio goodness. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes to help quiet Fran's essential tremor.
It'll never happen. It will never happen.
Oh my God, it really is a problem, you guys.
Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Food for Thought Pod, on Instagram at Gay Sluts Who Read. Sign up for our newsletter for episode insights, reading lists, and extra delectable content at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. And finally, send your questions, thoughts, concerns, and dick pics to thoughts at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. As always, that's food, the number 4, and thought spelled how?
Everybody, T-H-O-T.
Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.